Hi everyone, this is Sim.
This is Ko.
And welcome to another episode of Work in Progress.
Today we have with us Tulsi Menon, who's born and raised in Bangalore, India. She earned her Bachelor's of Arts in Anthropology from Macalester College and her Master's in Digital Anthropology at UCL London. She subsequently worked there for a few years before returning to India. Through that period, she solidified her vision of applying anthropological practices in the corporate environment and now has switched to being an independent consultant, and that's how we sort of reached out to her. What's really beautiful is she advocates for bringing anthropology out of academia and into business applications. She emphasizes on the importance of understanding how brands can fit into people's lives rather than forcing people to fit into a brand's life. Her expertise particularly shines in crafting strategies for the complex Indian market, whether working with established brands or those new to the landscape. She's also been featured as a speaker at TEDx, where she discussed the application of anthropological practices in business context, which everyone should check out because I learned a lot when I watched that talk. So thank you so much for being here.
But just, I think, building off of what Ko said about your introduction, about taking traditional anthropology and like taking it away from academia. I remember when I was in college, we had a business anthropology course and we were learning things about like the Khasis of Meghalaya and how that maybe showcases a matriarchal structure and showcases how maybe women have more spending power or influence on spending decisions, or like the Dabbawalas of Mumbai and how that also like logistical system is something we can learn from. So from your experience, how the anthropology you practice either builds on such concepts that we learn in school, or is it completely different?
No, it's building upon that. It's really just understanding why people are why they are, what makes us who we are, what makes us as a community who we are. And I just use the same practices and apply it into the business world. And why I've applied it into the business world is because it's a really interesting confluence of people from all over the world or all different walks of life that come together in one office or come together at one agency. And you're starting to see just how different cultures come together in one's physical space. And that was one of the things that really excited me about studying business anthropology.
I think, like, before getting into that, just a little bit about why, like, your background, your path, like, what made you curious enough to actually get into it in the first place?
Okay, yeah, sure. So when I was doing my A-levels in Bangalore, I was doing sociology, and there were just all these subjects that I was trying out, and when my teacher, when she was teaching it to me, it just felt right because it was helping me understand people. And it was just such a broader perspective. It was opening my eyes to just, I'd never seen the world in that way. I'd always had this sense of curiosity, always loved to hear people's stories. This helped me put kind of a framework to that. So when I went to do my bachelor's, much to my parents, Indian parents' dismay, they were like, go do economics, go do engineering, do something in that field. And I took one anthropology class and honestly just fell in love.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things that I knew that I'd found kind of my calling in a way, or I just found what I wanted to do. But I think the switch that had happened from just pure anthropology to business anthropology or anthropology in the corporate world happened while I was at Macalester. Was because when you studied anthropology, and this is what, I don't know how many years ago now, but how many ever years ago, it was a lot of the communities you study are tribal. A lot of the communities you study are, what I realized, were very close to our communities. So a lot of the communities we grew up knowing, or maybe our ancestors knowing, your grandparents, part of your grandparents' communities, were communities we were studying at Macalester, or where you would study in college. And while I found that really exciting, I also saw this aspect of a lot of these tribes being exoticized.
Yeah.
And in a way, I was like, hey, but that's kind of where I'm coming from. And so my culture is being exoticized in a way. So I think the first level of going into business was in a way to collapse that exoticism and say, can I study something that all of us are in, or all of us understand, or all of us can like put our heads in and study, and not of this like, oh, this is a far off tribal culture. And the second, to be very honest, was coming from India, parents have sent me abroad. I knew that at that time, anthropology had very few avenues. You would either go into academia, you would go do your PhD, you would go do development, you would go and work in a development sector. And financially, that didn't, while it sounded really exciting, I had to be practical as well. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just said, okay, I'm going to see if this works. And at that time, there were very few business anthropologists to say, okay, I'm just going to see if it works. So far it has, but yeah, that's kind of the pathway I went.
And how would you say it was different when you did digital anthropology? Because I think because that also is super interesting as a switch. And then I'm sure it led into, okay, this makes sense to apply to brands, businesses and that context.
Yeah, so I actually, so after I did my undergrad, I came back to India and I first worked in management consulting where I tried to see, okay, can we use anthropological practices in places where structures are very much set in stone? It was probably the hardest 2 years of my corporate, of just the working world because they have such
rigid.
Firm and rigid structures, exactly. And then I switched to the agency world where there was a lot more fluidity, a lot more cultural insights. But as I was working there, I realized the digital world was booming. And as an anthropologist, we've been taught how to study a physical culture. We didn't really know how to study a digital culture. Mm-hmm. And that led me to UCL. And at that time, it was the only place that was offering that, digital anthropology. And what I loved about it, the essence of digital anthropology is basically saying the digital is a culture in and of itself. Okay. So the same way that we study the physical as a culture with the same rigor, with the same academic lens, with different frameworks, we need to apply that to the digital world. So both we can study them separately, but we also have to study the confluence and what is our, as humans, our relationship with both.
With it. And especially now where we definitely spend a lot more time online than the physical world and like all those things, I think, interchanging, which makes me like ask the next question about identity. And you spoke about, I think, a lot of me's, and I read something which was like the multitude of self now, mm-hmm. Which at that point, I'm sure was, we're trying to understand internet culture. We're trying to understand. But now that it's all the same, and I feel even more so, like you can express so much more. And I think everyone has 4 or 5 versions of themselves. Like, one, what do you think of that? What do you make of that? And then how does it actually impact societal changes, especially when it comes to work or it comes, like we were speaking, when it comes to work or it comes to how you just, you know, present yourself in keeping in mind all the forces at play?
So I think one of the big changes I've seen is when I first started studying the virtual world or the digital world, what everyone would call it was the world that we're living in right now, the physical world is real and the virtual world was unreal.
Yeah. Mm.
And that dichotomy was really interesting. And if you look at it now, 5, 6 years later, that's not the case. Not the case. No one says that's not the real world because people feel that's probably even more real in a way. And I think that juxtaposition or that change has shown us how, as people, we've allowed ourselves or to live in multiple spaces. So right now, the focus is on the digital and virtual. I would hedge my bets 10 years down the line, there might be a different world that has equal gravitas or equal importance in our lives. And going to the question of multi-identities, what these two worlds have helped us do is express ourselves in multiple ways or play around with our different parts of us in different ways, because the digital world has allowed us to connect with people. It has allowed us to also assume identities that may not entirely be ours, but we've been able to tease our identities out, see what works, see what doesn't work. Sometimes when it doesn't work, change your identity and start something new. So I think that's been really interesting to observe.
Yeah. And like, how do you think it impacts a work context, like the rigidity you spoke about earlier, which does exist? I would argue it's not just consulting, I think across all, especially more with corporates. So how do you think that, you know, becomes, especially for younger people, becomes something that they should consider, where you're supposed to, well, you're said you bring your whole self to work, but what does that even mean today, you know, and is that accepted? And
so, you know, the concept of the whole self, I find fascinating because I believe in this idea of or at least I believe we're moving away from linearity. So we as people are more focused on lateral growth. And which what that means is that we can have multiple identities, multiple spaces. I am not just an anthropologist. That's not just my identity. I have multiple other aspects. And now people are picking and choosing what they want to bring to work.
Yeah.
So when that concept of bring your whole self to work in the beginning was, I think, quite fascinating. And everyone was like, I want to show you everything of who I am. But now people are realizing that because work is not the end all be all, I don't have to bring all of these aspects to work. I have another space where I can play around with a different identity. So this idea that we are no longer linear selves, that we don't have to go from A to B to C, but we're kind of like spreading ourselves wider, I think that has been a very interesting change. Shift. And that's really impacted how people even see work.
Yeah. Or even if you were building a company or like in terms of organization structure, because when you have hierarchies, it's also assumed roles. And it's also, I'm not saying that that isn't confluence with identity, but I think, do you see that as a structure also changing a lot?
Yes and no. So I think hierarchies are very much part of culture, part of our lives. I think if we look back into history, there's always some form of hierarchy, whether it's through religion, whether it's even through tribals, there's always someone or some people who had the power, and that tends to be how things need to run. What I think the change is, there might be more distributed hierarchy. So maybe not just one person at the top, and maybe that one person at the top may not be asking for very normative standards. The standards of which the work in and of itself is changing. And so there, the hierarchy, while the hierarchy is still there, what the leaders are asking for or what the leaders want will shift.
Also, like when you spoke about multiple me in your podcast, it really, I think, resonated with both of us, because like while we do have what we do at work and we're passionate about it, like even, for example, doing this podcast, like we wouldn't be able to put this aspect of ourselves in that. But it just made me think more about like traditional work environments in India also. There are so many family businesses, for example. Now, if you think of multiple me and bringing your whole aspect to work, like in a family business, how do you like navigate that? Because there's familial obligations, there's work obligations, and then there might be so many different passions you have of yourself and which you might want to explore, or different communities you would want to explore. So is that something like you've thought about at all?
I think yes, and I think that's a great question. And I think the this idea of multiple me, I have to caveat by saying it, I think it's a very privileged lens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people who have a lot of agency and choice right now are able to play around with their different identities, are able to, like, for example, I've taken a step back from doing a 9-to-5 and I consult now so I can focus on the other aspects that give me joy or give me happiness or give me energy.
Mm-hmm.
But that is very much a privileged lens that has enabled me to do that. I think when there are family businesses, the structures are so
rigid,
exactly. And it's passed down from generation to generation. To break that schema takes a lot. So what you might see is people not breaking the schema when they're at work, but finding places outside of work where they try to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
But at work, they might seem like themselves or like what the family requires of them.
Fair enough. Also, like personally, I work at an agency right now, and we had, coming out of COVID, we had like a flexible work environment where we used to go to work this whole concept, right? 3 days at work, 2 days at home. And that honestly let me explore this multiple me aspect much more. I was able to dabble in a lot more things. But now we are coming back to all 5 days working from office. And like the way the leadership presented it is like, okay, we need to embrace whatever y'all want to do at work. We need to make work more fun. If you want to go and play table tennis, please play table tennis. Like, you know, designate that time for yourself.
Yeah.
Do you see more like organizations or businesses trying to, like, seeing this, seeing that people are having different side hustles or different passions, trying to incorporate some of that into their businesses right now to be able to make people more comfortable coming back to work or just being at work completely? Or do you think that's not possible at all?
I think it's definitely possible. I'm not a fan of 5 days a week at
work. Neither am I. No one is.
But I think the point that you're bringing up is really important because, I think I might have spoken about this before, but what I think companies are doing right now is trying to build a culture of acceptance. Mm-hmm. What I see the shift that's required is a culture of excellence. Mm-hmm. And what that means is a culture of acceptance is saying, and going back to the point of hierarchies, is saying that, okay, this is the organization, this is the structure. We understand you are different. We understand you have different needs. Come into our space,
exactly.
But our very clear boundaries, and we will play around with it. We will give you that table tennis thing so you can feel like play is very important aspect of your life. You can play table tennis. Not knocking your agency. I don't.
No, please knock ahead.
But the switch is, I think, when you move to a culture of excellence. Mm-hmm. So when the company or the leaders say, I actually want people who are different. So I'm not, rather than getting my structure, having structures and getting them to be here, I'm going to change my structures around them. So, and it moves to a larger conversation of non-normative ways of working. So for example, and I think this example I think helps understand a lot when you change the structures. For example, someone who has a learning disability. If you change the structures to say, rather than I want you to fit into my work, but I'm going to hero you, I'm going to see what working system makes it best for you, because mm-hmm. I want to get the best out of you and I want you to be the best. So when you switch the structures, you're actually creating a culture of excellence. So you're not asking them to fully adapt to you, mm-hmm. but you're saying, where can we meet in the middle and actually meet them more on their end.
Yeah. Fair. But I think that there's a tension there, which, yeah, ideally this should be the case. But if you take specifically India, if you take the US now, there's a lot of pushback on DEI. There's a lot of pushback on after COVID. It's the norm to be in office 5 days a week, because ultimately we're not going to have this space to create for you if we're not making money.
Yeah.
Similarly here, every week there's some CEO who will say you need to work 80 hours a week, 90 hours, 100 hours, whatever. So I feel like both of those things are happening in parallel. One where businesses are realizing that, hey, especially younger people coming into the workforce, they probably won't come to the workforce or they won't be interested because they have five other things and five other avenues with which they can make money. Or then you have the serious businesses, so to speak, mm-hmm. who are like, we don't have, the space for this. It's like bottom line first. So the era of DEI, the era of, all of those things is slowly getting over because we need to shift back. And like, so how do you see that? Do you feel like it's going to be this tension where both happen in parallel, or there will be some confluence where, there's never going to be one ideal way of working, but I do see both of these actually increasing more and more and more.
I agree with you. I think it's both happening, and it's kind of like this both parallel worlds that are happening. And I think what we're in the place in India with this whole 90-hour work week, if someone says no to it, there are 1,000 people who will say yes to it. So it won't change the structure. And again, like going back to the idea of privilege, I think the ones who are able to say no to it have the choice, are working in less traditional structures already. But the people who can't say no to it have families, have responsibilities, have social mobility is important for them. They have to provide for families. They have to do a lot more. So those traditional structures, I think, will last. And I think what that tension you're bringing up might create a very polarizing culture where there's on one hand people talking about my identity, this is what I want, this is how I experience the world, I don't need to work so much, I only go to work twice a week, etc. And then you have these people who are saying, I grind, I'm at work on Saturday, I'm at work on Sunday. And what I think will happen is conflict between the two, because you won't be able to understand each other's perspectives or lives anymore. Mm-hmm. And there again, we'll create hierarchy.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see really how that pans out. I think specifically for the younger generation, because they're you have the flexibility of choosing.
Mm-hmm.
I think with maybe not us, but people a little bit older, especially in India, there is a set way and there are a lot more life constraints that you have to work with. Whereas now it's possible for you to say, this is my priority. And hey, you know what? I can actually make some more money, whether it's being whatever it might be, but I have that option and the availability. So will you really create that space for you, or will you adopt to a space that's already there? I think it'll be super interesting in maybe 10 years to do a check-in and see how both play out. Because I think in the US there's a lot of that happening with,
Sorry, just on that, one of the things that I would love to add is I think for the work structure to change, how we look at the world needs to change.
Yeah.
And going back to the conversation that I was saying about linearity. So we've been taught, and not only in India, everywhere over the world, you get a good education, you get a good job, you get a vehicle, you get married, you have kids, you get a house, and so on. I mean, some you might get the house before, whatever, but there's a linearity to life. So everyone has this milestone. If these milestones are still very much part of our culture, the work culture won't change because people are always looking for the next. If these milestones become less valued, so where you say marriage is not my end all, kids may not be my end all, owning a house may not be my end all. And we're seeing a lot of the younger generation
feel that way.
That helps them look at work in a very different way.
Yeah.
And that will cause the change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for sure, very visibly, you see, it's like the meme, right? Like my parents at 30 with the house and then me at 30 with iced latte. It's fully the vibe. I think a little bit to shift gears into when you work with brands and businesses, I think we can separate both. One is brands and then businesses. How do you actually go about it? Because I work in the field, and a lot of times when you do research or when you get a consultant on board who's going to help you understand culture, just headline wise, they're very distinct ways the brand as well as the a consultancy would approach it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's answering an already agreed upon end state. Mm-hmm. We want this result, and hence let's backtrack it. Or it's really immersing understanding, which of course is a long process.
Yeah.
There's no time frame, but it's a long process. You really have to spend time with the consumer or, whoever your target audience is. So how have you seen that, evolve? I'm curious to know what kinds of brands and businesses are actually asking and really putting in the effort to know their consumer better and to actually answer that I want to fit into their life and not the other way around.
I think so. Brands that have either lost a lot of market share or that were doing really good, but now the trend is fully shifted. For example, one of the brands that I was working on was a whiskey brand, and they saw this whole trend to gin. And they were like, how do we make whiskey more relevant? And they realized that we can't just create another product and sell it because people have lost the affinity to whiskey. Women weren't drinking whiskey this is what we found in the research, but women weren't drinking whiskey because it seemed like a very manly drink, the color, the glass, how it was depicted in popular culture. So with projects like that, where there is no answer, but they want to do something different, the scope is amazing. You can go deep. You actually, for those kind of projects, you don't go brand first. Very rarely in the research, do you start off by talking whiskey? We started off by studying their behavior to experimentation, to exploring lives, because that we saw was a way in for people to maybe experiment with a new type of whiskey, and therefore what would that whiskey be? But you get a lot of the brands which have, like you said, have said, this is what we need to get to. And what I saw a lot of the times was with those brands, the insight that you would get, you might be really happy with the insight, but it doesn't translate into action. Mm-hmm. Or that insight stays on PowerPoint page number 80, and it's a good to have, and it's just like a picture of all these different faces saying, we spoke to 50 people and they said this, and the business doesn't really care about it. What I've learned, what you can do there and how anthropology works there, where research is minimal, you help them reframe their brand problem from a cultural perspective. You help them look look at it. So they say, I want to get to X, but you help them look at it, or you direct them into a different way of thinking. Show multi perspectives of this is what the world, what's happening in the world, and help direct it that way. And I think anthropology helps in both spaces in very distinct ways. One is about opening up a way of thinking, and one is about role, getting to a deep understanding of human behavior, what culture wants through research, and then opening up possibilities.
Just like when you approach it though, like how do you, of course, like if it's a whiskey brand, I'm assuming it's a bit more premium, and then you're very clear on the kind of person you're talking to, and it's easier to decipher. Again, I'm curious to know, have you been able to crack if there's a brand that's maybe mass or even lower than mass, where you really have to know all of the nuances in culture, not broad level what works, but what's relevant, what people are going to gravitate towards. And again, is it derived from more observing internet culture and like what's what people are observing, liking, or is it spending time with people in different places, age groups, blah, blah, or is it both? Like, how do you actually approach those kind of problems? Because I think with luxury, with, I would say, premium, there is a way that is, you would know it's taste dependent and you just know it. But with this, I'm finding it harder and harder. Or you're someone who just connects. And I think that there's sometimes a gap because a lot of people working with brands do come from a bit of a privileged lens. And then that's where there's a bit of a dissonance. And they think that we like it sitting in our office in Bandra, but people are not going to like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great question. And I think the first, and what I always advocate for, is to, when you start a project, to do an autoethnography. And what that means is, so ethnography in anthropology, that's the research method we use to study people. You do it on yourself first as the researcher or the strategist to understand your biases. Because like you said, privilege is a huge bias. So we'll never be rid of our biases, but if you're aware of it before you go into doing the research, it really helps you check yourself to say, okay, I am assuming they are thinking this, but why? It's because of my own experiences. But once you start to like clearly understand where you're coming from, you're able to walk in their shoes a lot more. And the thing about people, whether mass, whether premium, they love to tell you their stories. And as anthropologists, what you have to be good at is just listen. You don't, and I think where the big change of what market research is versus like an anthropological research is, you don't really direct the conversation. You direct it in a way of, you're guiding, you're partnering with them, but you're never leading the conversation. So you're listening to what their world is like. You're actually walking in their shoes. They might take you on a walk. They might take you into their house. They might, like, for example, talking about whiskey, some of the most interesting insights were when I went to Ludhiana. And it was a bunch of men. And like, I stand out very differently in a place like Ludhiana. But to hear how they talk about it. But again, if I was coming just from my privileged background and not, maybe you would even judge people. For example, they were talking about whiskey with so much love. It was amazing to see. And at one point they said, if we're talking about whiskey, why is there no whiskey on the table with us? Because that's how we...
Show love.
But that was an insight in and of itself, because we don't think about it that way. Yeah. But that's how they do. Yeah. And that just going back to just observing them and just being with them. And there's an acceptance that we are different, but we're here to be together for this hour, for this
minute
for whatever it is, and we'll be connected. And I think when you give people the time to talk, and when you show that you actively want to hear, people are open. People are, they let go of what they think you want to hear.
Exactly.
And they start to tell you their story. And then to add on that, so one is to do that kind of research, but I think on top of that, to understand, especially in spaces that I may not have knowledge, or you may not have knowledge, is to do semiotics understanding. How has the world evolved? So how has the world evolved from 100 years ago, 50 years ago, what were the residual codes? What are the emerging codes? And we can see a lot of this through pop culture, because pop culture shows us how, and taking alcohol as an example, we've seen the evolution of how alcohol has been portrayed in the media. And that gives us a clear signal of what's happening
in
India, or happening across cultures.
Yeah. This just reminded me actually something that you had said at your TED Talk, which was the difference in how we present ourselves as well. So I might tell you I'm super healthy and I'm very active and I really want, like, you know, these are the things that I want to do. But you'll come to my house and then you'll see all these snacks and you'll see, but that's not for me. And then you'll ask me, but did you eat? And I'll be like, yeah, I had one or two. So the dissonance between who you want to be projected as or seen as versus what you actually do, because that's very important. If I'm doing a survey and it's like, yeah, everyone's saying they want to be healthy or they're healthy, but then they're patterns are completely different. So I think even, I think there was a report that said that when you're anonymously filling forms, you're a lot truer because you know, there's no, again, like conflict. But sometimes when you're asked and you're not comfortable, you will blatantly lie because you don't want to seem as someone, oh, I can't be seen as someone who doesn't do that because that's in conflict with who I think I am.
Yeah.
So again, that would be interesting to know, how do you keep in mind the biases, or do you just observe in their most natural environment? Like, how do you?
So I think, so the example you gave, honestly, that when I was exploring that is one of my favorite examples to talk about, because it shows the difference. It shows, like, I walked into his house and he was talking about how healthy he was, went into his kitchen and there was like 100 potatoes being deep fried. but he said it was because he had a party, and he said, how can I show diet food at a party?
Yeah.
And that gave a different insight of how in India, status food is rich and like filled with ghee, filled with butter. And so health is incongruent in that area. But I think when people talk like this, or what they say and what they do is different, it shows us that we have many contradictions within us. We are contradictory. And it goes back to that idea of multiple me's. The multiple selves are not always not always happy, not always together. We have contradictions. You might have one aspect of yourself that feels one way and the other aspect that actually is a bit in conflict of this other avenue. And so I don't see it as people lying, but I see it as people trying to show one aspect of themselves. And we focus on, okay, why are they trying to bring that aspect of themselves to this table right now? What is it about the setting? What is it that they're trying to show? And I think when you delayer, you get to that emotional human motivation, and that's your insight. And that's honestly beautiful to find.
Yeah.
So, like, talking about, like, how anthropological research, like ethnographies and all work, like, I feel hearing about it makes it feel like the ideal choice. Like, you're understanding the why behind it. So I work in a PR agency, and right now my clients are mostly pharmaceuticals. One of my clients is, like, working in the diabetes space. And one thing we wanted to do was understand why people with diabetes right now are not very open to using technology, which is the CGM, which everyone must have seen on their, like, people's arms. Mostly people, like, who are fitness freaks or, like, really want to think about how much they're putting in their body, they are more open to using it than people with diabetes. So this whole conversation happened at work, and, like, we were thinking, okay, how would we approach it? Everyone, out of five people, four people's answers was, chalo, let's do one survey. So, like, when you think about, like, oh, doing a survey, we had, like Kohan mentioned, we had spoken to an anthropologist before. So had just mentioned, like, okay, there might be a different way to, like, find these insights. But then the answer I got back was scalability and price.
Yeah.
So that's a dilemma that comes across for businesses or, like, brands or companies, that they might want to get these insights, but getting that scalability aspect of like, oh, I spoke to 400 people, like you said on that PowerPoint presentation, or like from a price perspective or a time perspective. So like in your work, how do you like approach that, or how do you showcase to businesses that, yes, this is an option, but this is why you might get like better, more quality insights?
So one of the things I say, and especially when you're doing a survey, is when you ask someone a why, you're not going to get the answer.
And it's always like multiple choice. Yeah. Like you're already giving them options. What if they had a other?
Yeah, you're leading them into a specific answer that you want. And you're asking them, because the first why is never the real why. Mm-hmm. And in a survey, you're only going to get the first why or the why that you have led them into. The fifth why might be the real why. Mm-hmm. But anthropological research or just any ethnography or work in that space helps you get to that why. Mm-hmm. It helps you situate the person in the context of their lives. So you start to see who they are and why they're doing what they're doing. And then it gives you that deeper motivation. Yes, it's not scalable. This kind of research is never meant to be scalable. You can't do in-depth research with 100, 200 people. Mm-hmm. What you can do is use large data sets to get patterns of behavior. So you use big data, get patterns of behavior, identify maybe the segment that is most interest, that the segment that has, we have a lot of questions for, or different segments that we want to explore, find people within those segments. And there it's not about quantity, it's about quality. It's about getting a deep insight. So you don't need to speak to those 100 people. You need to speak to maybe 8 to 16 to sometimes 4. Mm-hmm. And it's really spending time with them. But I think what you're talking about, the scalability and the fear, is real, but you have to manage the data with the qualitative and the quantitative. If you can bring both together, brands are more likely willing to buy in, because you're going to show them, here are the insights that I've got from these participants. Mm-hmm. And now through data sets, through, let's say, things like YouGov, we're going to scale it up and we'll get the large answer.
So it can work in confluence, in conjunction. Yeah,
very much so. And it should work in conjunction. What has happened is people see it as an either or.
Yes.
It doesn't need to be an either or. You just need to invest a little more time into the qualitative data aspect. Companies now are willing to do that. They're not willing to do 6 months or anything, and that's fine. In business anthropology, we've switched it so that you don't do really long research, because you can't. We understand that no brand is going to say, here, take
1 year,
2 years. I mean, that would be the dream, but no one's going to do that. We've built modules or models where it's done in a much shorter time. But you have to give a month, you have to give 6 weeks, you have to give a few weeks to get some insights, because otherwise you're not.
Also thinking about like business anthropology in general, and just thinking about where India is at this point. Mm-hmm. We think about India as both traditional and aspirational at the same time. We have the government talking about Make in India. We have entrepreneurs like Nikhil Kama talking about like, oh, everything can be made in India. A rise in homegrown brands. Mm-hmm. But we also see a rise in people wanting to adapt or like take part in Western culture, or like spend on Western culture. So I'm sure like you've worked with so many brands, like, so there's a tension between the two ethoses for people. Mm-hmm. Every day, like, do you see that? How do you talk about it, or how do you approach it when you're advising a brand? That do they lean more homegrown, do they lean more like from a Western perspective, or there is a healthy mix in the middle?
I think it depends on the sector, it depends on the segmentation of the audience, but on a large scale, there is this resurgence of homegrown. There is this resurgence of, we want to take what has been taken from us and make it our own again. Mm-hmm. In this, like, we see it in the space of yoga, we see it in the space of Haldi Dood, we see it in all of those spaces where we're reclaiming it and saying this is ours. I think the aspirations of the West or the may never go away because of the colonial, because of colonization.
Fair.
And that has been so ingrained in us that the Western ideal has become the has become the ideal for most. You are seeing small behaviors of, like I said, reclaiming it. And so right now it's a very interesting, there's conflict, I think, where brands don't know which way to play, which one will give them
a bigger bite of the pie. Sorry.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's my wish, or what I think is going to happen across the world. Mm-hmm. People are noticing us, and therefore that helps people with in the country say, I reclaim my identity. I mm-hmm. reclaim my Indianness. So I think that's definitely happening. But there will always be, there's this thing called ethnoscapes, which is we are now, whether we want to or not, we are multicultural. So there's the global, there's the local, there's the local. Mm-hmm. We will always be connected to different cultures. What we need to do is learn how to celebrate our own while understanding and borrowing from others, rather than celebrating the others and maybe just putting a little of ours in it.
Which I feel like is completely fine, and it's good to have that balance. Like, I think it just comes down to how are you investing more to be a part of my life, like in a very simple way. For example, Nike is doing so much now, I feel, here on running, mm-hmm. Where they have their own club, and like, you know, that I thought that it's just something that they're doing namesake, but they are showing up and they're becoming part of my life, and they're making me excited to do things. And I feel it's as simple as that. Like, sure, there can be different trends, and that's a choice you make as a consumer that I want to only buy homegrown brands. But then once you've made the choice, I think it's onus on the brand of how do I keep turning up, or how do I, you know, continue that relationship with you.
Yeah.
So I feel like that tension is always going to be there. I think for brands, it's just to keep this in mind. And I feel not unfortunately, but I think a lot of the global brands do that better. I think there is attempt now with mm-hmm. a lot, like maybe an athleisure, Bliss Club, you know, does well, and they really double down. But I think there's too short a time, maybe like 20, 30 years down, if they're still relevant, then sure.
Yeah. I think a good example we've seen in the recent past is makeup in India, where it's being made for brown skin.
Yeah.
Like, first time. Because I think that maybe when we were growing up and people were wearing makeup, they were just... nothing was for our skin. Now that it's building, it's not only building for Indians or making it a homegrown brand, but like you're saying, it's building for the Indian body. It's building for the Indian value systems. It's building for the Indian mindset, the Indian ethics. That builds a more enduring brand today, because then you see that, hey, this brand really gets me. It gets who I am or who I want to be. And it's catering to that. And therefore, I will take this brand with me as I evolve through time.
Yeah. I think one thing that I really wanted to talk to you about was like the role of women. So just let me contextualize it. Like, one is that since we've got a lot more data, women in rural, you know, places don't have to spend time washing, don't have to spend time, you know, like electricity is free. So they just have more time, more agency. Sure, they're slowly getting financially better. But recently I read this whole thing where it said that the amount of bank accounts that women are opening is more, enrollment in school is more. So there's just generally more agency. But again, tension of caregiving responsibilities, like my time is still going to go there. But now I want to express, and like something as not small, but significant, that I have internet. I can just create my content and then go viral out of nowhere. And that's it. And that's my business. Like the so beautiful, so lovely, like that lady, right? And you see a lot of women entrepreneurs now coming into the scene. So how do you, you know, because I feel like the structures are changing, like globally as well. There was the CEO of a bank like yesterday who spoke about the same thing, that on a financial level, a lot more women are, you know, just getting more literate. The share that we will hold is going to increase. Mm-hmm. So agency to express, therefore, will increase a lot more. And so how do you see that balance with the fact that I'm still going to have this unpaid care responsibility? I'm still going to have these things. And how does that structure change? How does it impact work as well, because the policies haven't really changed much.
Yeah.
So I still have that reality of I want to do all of these things, but then I'm stuck because, you know, it's not conducive, or it's not conducive a space for me. So how do you think that one, like employees can, you know, make it better? And how do you think it's going to change for women? Like, are they going to just be like, why do I need to do these 10 things?
I think, well, so this idea of the dual roles is very much... has been there for ages for women. It's the unpaid labor, let's say, not only taking care of the kids, but just the home, taking care of the home, even stuff like the veggies. Like, there's a lot of physical and emotional labor that takes place that's not accounted for.
Yeah.
And then they're now in the workforce where they have to do as much as the men do. I don't right now. I think some companies make allowances for it, but on the whole, it's that idea of celebrating the superwoman, and it's in a way basically saying to these women, you are superwoman, therefore you can and must do the two roles. Again, we're not going to change the structure for you. We're just going to celebrate the fact that you can and you can do it all. And that is such a burden for any person to take on, because then you become the leader in this, or you can't say no, because you want to, you feel that you have a duty to two roles suddenly. And now we're adding these multiple me aspects, and we're saying, hey, women, or hey, people, you can now express your identity in many ways. And they're like, how many hands do I have to juggle all of these? So I actually don't even have an answer for how it's gonna evolve. I think we have to just be very conscious of the changes that will be required in family structures, or of what what's being asked for in with women in the family roles, what agency they have, and conversations that happen in the house that gives women the ability to say no, or gives women the ability to say, I need help with this.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing changes happen, but I actually don't even have an answer for how it's going to evolve.
I think it'll just be like super interesting, because again, I think there'll be some pushback. And then it's again, who is control? Like, I was thinking right now with older people, like, how would all of this, when someone comes in saying, I have multiple me's, like, how do they react when someone's 60, 70? Not to generalize, like, there are a lot of amazing people who are super open and adapting, maybe better than us, but in general, of, you know, hey, like, I don't know what you're talking about, you come here, you like do your job and you go back, like, why are you making this stressful? So I feel it'd be interesting, because I think a lot of that influence comes top down. Maybe that structure changes, where it's, you know, there is no structure. There is like, hey, this is the problem we're coming together to solve. And it doesn't matter then what, where, how. We'll make it the best environment for you. Like, to me, that's the ideal case. But it'd be interesting to see how that sort of changes in...
I think that's a really important point that you've brought up, because like the top-down and bottom-up structure, what is happening right now is us or people... like who are not that old, are expecting the older generation to change, to get it. How will they get it if they haven't had the same lived experiences that we do? So the expectations we have of them also need to change.
Yeah.
And because what happens, and I think this is a huge trend that's happening in the world, this polarization. We're talking at each other, but we're not talking with. And we're not building and creating together. So for the older generation to get where we're coming from, and for us to also get where they're coming from, it has to be a fluid conversation. It has to be a sharing of ideas, a sharing of experiences, not just one way.
Yeah.
Also, just talking about women in general, the internet, since you're a digital anthropologist, has empowered women in many ways. Like she was also mentioning, there like a burst of female influencers from all sects of life, and they are really having conversations online. And the gender dynamics on the internet, I find, are very different from gender dynamics I feel maybe in real life. And also, just, it's a open question, it's not really related to business or any, it's like consumer behavior overall, but like women are putting themselves more out there, I feel, online. But and they're empowered to do so. Maybe there's a little conflict of doing the same thing in traditional real life. And also it's like getting corresponded with, like, men being like commenting on whatever these women are doing, whether yeah. they're selling a product or just putting a picture.
Yeah.
But just the whole aspect of gender dynamics on the internet versus real life is something that I have been thinking about and thought, like, if you have any interesting insights that you have found while
yeah.
doing your
I
research.
I think just
as
to
well.
Add, like, it's not even women. I think LGBTQ, that community, like the community in general, I think that's the biggest place where there is a difference. Like, I firstly feel it's the same. Like, I don't think there's internet life and like it's one. Like, yeah. you can't differentiate. But, like, I feel for them specifically to express and to find avenues, I think that's been, like, the most powerful. Like, I'd be interested to know what you make of that as well. I think for women, yes, like, there are dynamics. But I think for that community, because it is very different, especially if you put in India context.
Yeah.
Like, it's not the same.
Yeah.
And I think there is, like, oh, my internet self versus my digital, yeah. I mean, my physical self.
Yeah. So I think a few things from what you're saying. One is, people have the ability to make money while they're at home,
yeah.
which is huge. What it also does is, speaking about the LGBTQ community or any communities, when people haven't been able to find their communities in the physical world, the digital has done a great help in finding those communities, finding a sense of self, finding a sense of belonging, finding connection. And what we're seeing now is those translate back into the physical
yeah.
world.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the same, but they're different. But now they're working hand in hand. Yes, we do get the dynamics where a lot of comments and people, the hate that people get online. But it's what I see it as, the hate is still there offline.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a medium through which it's being expressed now. It's more visible,
but it's always been there.
It's become more permissible because of freedom of speech, because of the medium, because of how role models or leaders are acting now.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's become more permissible, but it's always been there. It's just we're just now seeing it. Way more.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And just from a internet and like being on in the digital world, you find yourself like being gravitated towards certain communities. So building your own community.
Yeah.
Like through this podcast, we are trying to build a community. If you're writing a Substack, you're trying to build a community. So how like maybe businesses are really trying to tap into that community? And have you seen like some examples, I guess, of how they're trying to do that from an online perspective?
So one of the things that is happening everywhere and all the time, and I'm sure both of you have heard it, is like businesses and brands saying, we want that viral moment.
Yes,
we want that viral reel, right? They want behavior right now is all of us have like 5 seconds to spend. You'll remember it. And then we'll go on to the next thing. So every brand is trying to fight for those 5 seconds or 20 seconds. So everyone is trying to get this viral moment. What's happening with that is it's not enduring. It's not like I don't remember last month's viral reel or whatever. And what it's also impacting culture. I was thinking about it from a music perspective,
mm-hmm.
right? The music I've grown up on, my parents' music, the Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, all of that have stood the test of time. The music that's happening right now is all attention grabbing, all catered to
have that 30 second reel.
Exactly. And that dance. And while it's an in the moment great feeling and it builds community, it definitely builds community. We're seeing communities being built as a result of it. I'm not entirely sure that that's enduring. We're not going to remember that song, that dance 6 months from now because there are so many viral moments.
No, I agree. Also, too, if you really look at it, the truest of viral moments are just random. They're not
yeah.
engineered.
Yeah.
And here we have like businesses and like brands trying to engineer that. That lady who was showing that outfit and she was like lovely and this, and that became a whole thing. That was
yeah.
just her being her.
Yeah.
It was not some business telling her, please do this. And like, you never know what 1,000 people are going to gravitate towards.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I think that like a little bit of, I know it's like tough to ask it, but from just a future perspective, or actually a good question is, right now I feel between, even if you take things like community building, or if you take things like internet culture, it's decentralized in a certain way, mm-hmm. so it flattens things out. But I still feel like there's a gap in terms of how consumers absorb things. So, for example, I might be, you know, consuming a lot of content that's specific to writers in California. Okay. And so that's my reference point. And maybe so then I know a lot about the internet, as opposed to someone here might just have a basic understanding. So would a brand or business be able to really know these kind of nuances when they're trying to connect with me, as opposed to, let's say, Simran, on a topic that I am so, you know, but broadly we're interested in, but I'm just like so specific about it. And maybe she's not, just because our influences
are different.
Yeah. So in one way, what I'm trying to say is definitely it's flattened out culture, but in another way, it's also allowed for these rabbit holes to happen.
Yeah.
So how do you really, you know, think about both these things? So is it, again, just things that are happening? Like you go wide and you go deep.
Yeah, I think that's what's happening. And I think it's kind of awesome that you see like these rabbit holes that people go through. Like people are finding the quirkiest, the most interesting rabbit holes on the internet that gives them deep culture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So culture is going really deep and you find that you're uncovering so much about this culture and therefore yourself. And there's big data that can help brands figure those out. What's interesting though is the behaviors or the values are still similar. So what you are interested in versus what you're interested in, your motivations might be different. But the values, the sense of needing to belong, the sense of whatever it is, validation, whatever those key behavioral buckets or umbrellas, those are still the same.
Yeah.
And so that's what connects us as humans. So you're able to start seeing the world in like very like huge buckets of, we need right now this, like, for example, just the sense of being on social media, right? Everyone talks about, and I think one of the things that you were asking before was about inauthenticity, right? Does social media breed inauthentic? We're showing one aspect of ourselves, we're engineering all of that. And yes, I agree with all of that. But I think if you take a step back, what social media has enabled is an acceptance of the ego, an acceptance of our need for validation. These are huge, huge human behavioral needs that maybe have not had that much space before, because, you know, being selfish was not accepted.
Yeah.
Being like all about the me was not accepted. Social media has, and it's shown us that these are things that people want. They want community, they want validation, and they're finding avenues to do it through their deep communities. But we're understanding a lot more. And so I would say it, sometimes it makes you inauthentic, but it's also maybe making us more authentic.
If exactly. That makes sense. Like what I've been thinking about a lot, which is just like, I read this thing where it termed it as performative authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the need to be authentic and you want to be true to yourself. But there is this lens of, am I doing this truly for me? Am I doing it to see? Same thing.
Yeah.
As you ask me, I want to be healthy, and then you come to my kitchen. But same thing, that I want to showcase that I am X person, but I have the need to be authentic. And there's a little bit, again, of like clashing against each other. There are, hence now there's a lot of, you know, I don't want to have an Instagram, aesthetic Instagram grid.
Yeah.
I don't want to have perfectly posted stories. I will be super random. I'll post from my notes app. Like there's a lot of pushback being like, I just want it to be as pure and as authentic. But again, are you doing that because you're seeing other people, you're like, hey, following, like now this is the way to be. So I feel like it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And like, what does that again do to your understanding of your identity? Because you're spending so much time online, life is online.
Yeah.
Like I've been personally thinking about it a lot, like how much of it is performative, how much of it is authentic, like
can all of it be performative, can all of it be authentic? Because is there ever a time where you are not, because we are so influenced by other people. Us sitting here today, we're influenced by each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you're seeing something that's making me think something, or vice versa. So we are always going to be learning from others, taking from others, giving to others. So I think there's always going to be an essence of performativity. And there's always going to be an essence of authenticity. And I think the question of who are you doing it for? Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it for others? That's also blurry.
Yeah.
And I think we're also moving to the space of accepting that it's okay if you're doing it for others. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if we're really evolving to the multiple me identities, we have to accept those identities that maybe don't sit really well with us right now. That identity that says, I want to do something super performative and I'm doing it just for you. I don't really feel like I want to do it, but I want to do it for you. If that's really how you feel, then
why not?
Yeah. I don't know. This is like a...
It's a broader... example, but, it's like, it's... Even on a really random thought, it was also about... You have one part where you said this superwoman identity for women and you feel like you have to do it. But then there was like this, again, this like tech CEO tweeted it, like woman CEO tweeted it, being like, actually now when she left her job and she was like, I just want to take care of my kid. I've like worked and like, that's what I want to do. And there was a lot of dissonance in how people reacted on one side being like, how could you do that? Or like, you know, you were doing so well. There were a lot of women who also were like, wow, like, I'm so glad that you're brave. And you know, that you're just like clear about this is what I want to do with life. And then again, with things like that, there's so much stigma of what if I don't want a career and I just want to have kids and I want, you know, those, or what if I never want to get married? Yeah. It's things like that where people again, like the larger questions, people again might inhibit themselves because of the pressure of performing or the pressure of, you know, this is how it's going to be, which is changing because people are talking about it more. But yeah, it'd be curious.
I think that's... It's really interesting because like women in the workforce or women specifically, you know, like now you're kind of exactly saying you're judged if you say, I don't want to work. I want to be at home with my kids, because it's like, is that all you want to do? No, it's not all. There's being at home with your kids is a lot, is a full-time thing anyway. And I think, you know, the viral community of trad wives. There's a reason why it's taken over. Of course, there's so much judgment across it.
Going to bring that up.
Yeah, right?
Because there's this famous trad, I don't want to call her trad wife, but she started the movement over there and she had done one interview and she was talking about like, at the beginning of the 90s, etc., when the bubble burst and all women were basically shoved into the workforce being like, now this is from a more US context, but I just wanted to bring it up, shoved into the workforce and they had to work to be able to like survive in this world. Now we have reached 20 plus years after that where women have now like had a... They have built a place in society, in the workforce.
Yeah.
Plus, they have built a place at home. And now, like you were saying, there's a freedom of choice. Like that time I was pushed in, but now it should be my choice whether I want to push out. And if I want to stay at home and take my sheep and make the wool and make the clothes and go on, take the cow and make the milk and make my food, what's the problem? And like, I want to embrace my more traditional feeling that I feel. And if you want to work, go work. But like, if I want to do this, let me do it. Yeah. But like, there's this uproar between the, like this trad wife movement and the women at large being like, oh, you're taking us back.
So many years.
30 years.
Also with men, I think, because there's so much, it's so interesting with men as well. There's so much masculinity context of like, you have to be the alpha. Like there's a lot of resurgence of that. Like alpha male provider, like with... how many of our podcasters are out there? And then there's also like, oh, but have men become too feminine now? Have men become too like soft now? So I feel like it's happening there as well. Like men also face it where I need to be this person who is like, if you're in, you know, like I need to be this person who's providing and I have that pressure. And for them to also be like, you know what, maybe I don't want to do that. And like, I want to lead a slow life is also very daunting.
No, my sister, like she's my younger sister, and like the one thing she's always told me is like, I'm doing this, I'm doing work, I'm like working all the time. And like when I look at my sister, I'm like, oh, what do you want to do in life? Like 2 weeks ago, she has told me, I just want to relax. I am born to relax. So she has said that and I just joked and I was like, who's... I find myself, like you all were saying, like maybe making a small judgment, being like, babe, come on, like get to work. But like... I think coming to it is just like acceptance. Like, okay, this is what gives her happiness
but
in life.
That's still, I feel, I'm saying privilege. Yeah. In terms of you
yeah.
can.
Yeah. yeah.
I'm saying more of like expression of how masculine or feminine do I want to appear as is a pressure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of.
Yeah. I think this is a really important point about the masculine aspect, because while we talk a lot about women and giving them agency, and especially in our very like patriarchal society, the men aren't asked what they want.
Yeah.
They are told, or they have been born knowing that they have to provide.
Yeah.
So giving them, like, you know, we've talked about like, the woman saying, I want to take a step back from work, less judgment. A man yeah. saying that will be riddled with so much judgment yeah. because then it's who'll provide, who mm-hmm. will do this, like you are the man of the house, what happens to your masculinity? And I think those are, like, you're like just so bang on. Those are conversations we need to have as well, because it's uplifting all genders, everyone, and really like giving everyone agency is giving everyone.
Yeah, because I think it is super, like there are a lot of women who are okay, but then it's because the pressure is on them. They don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting when you have to worry about it, but you're still thinking about, this is more important to me. So, for example, if a man's like, I don't want to, I don't feel motivated, and then still finding someone who accepts that, or which I don't think we're there yet, because yeah. there's a lot of, there it's as deep-rooted. But with the conversations that are happening, maybe in my pockets of the internet, I feel like it's slowly, like, changing. And it'll be interesting, again, to do a check-in in, like, yeah. 10, 20 years of how has that balance really changed. And it would be really cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's, I think I come from it from, a very unique perspective, because my mum, for a portion of our life, as I think I was a teenager onwards, was the primary breadwinner.
Mm.
So I've seen roles in very different ways, but I've also seen how that impacts masculinity and femininity ideals, or how society looks at it, or how the grandparents look at it because of structures of society. So I think you're at that time when it was happening, I think I didn't know anyone else who had that kind of structure. So mm-hmm. it was jarring, and it felt very, not jarring, I shouldn't say jarring, it was beautifully unique.
Yeah.
But it takes time to understand yourself.
Exactly. And now you're seeing a lot more of the conversation between partners, heteronormative and non, of just what roles do we want to do and what roles do we want to play, and what can you give and what can you give.
Yeah.
And I think when you're entering a partnership, maybe these are the kind of conversations to have, to see how do you envision your lives
and together.
Yeah. For me, honestly, my role models were my parents, because they gave, because it was a different relationship, because they're very different, very liberal, they gave me the space, and my brother the space, to question, to do anthropology, like to do something super different. And that gave the freedom of agency to question, to ask, is this, like, you've lived your life this way, but I don't know if I want to live my life this way. And I think having role models, or having communities where the conversations are happening, and it's you're able to have those conversations without fear of judgment. To say, hey, I think I have a different way of living. And I think with the younger generation, they're seeing a lot of that in their peers, where those mm-hmm. conversations are really becoming part and parcel of their life. And I think slowly it's going to become significantly more mainstream, because the kids talk to their parents about it. What we've seen the switch is, before, in the dynamics, a lot of the parents are teaching the kids. Now, because the world is changing so rapidly, the kids are on their laptops or on the digital world all the time, they're actually showing their parents the changing world. And so there is this beautiful relationship of, like, the cyclical relationship that you see in family dynamics, which will ultimately change the structure in and of itself.
Our podcast name is Work in Progress. We know anthropology as a subject is also discovering what's a work in progress and how it moves forward. So I'll ask from a business, like, from your work perspective, how do you think your work in general, or the work you're doing, is a work in progress, and where do you see yourself going?
Yeah, and also how are you a work in progress?
Every day is a work in progress. I see myself as constantly changing and constantly evolving. So I think I wholeheartedly believe that I will always be a work in progress. And I love that. Mm-hmm. So because that gives the space to always learn and grow. From a business perspective, the work in progress is to how to help brands really bring about behavioral change, not about just selling one more product. Mm-hmm. I've done that. It's been fun. It's been great. But how do we help brands really, truly understand culture and bring about step changes? It doesn't have to be a huge change, but small changes, small meaningful changes in people's lives.
What would you... One advice, and like, how do you stay? Of course, you have to be super online, you've studied it. But if someone, like, if I'm interested, like, how do I keep, what can I do? How can I keep up? Like, what do I read, watch, listen? You can even send links, but if there's anything that's just been profoundly like, hey, this thing, then you can share.
Actually, there's so many books that I would recommend, which I will give links
send
for.
Them to
from
me,
an anthropological perspective, the few that have really, over the years, been very impactful for me was Coming of Age in Second Life, which was basically this book. Second Life was this one of the first virtual worlds ever. And it was this anthropological study of it. And this is when it was real versus unreal world. And it was a study of these behaviors and how people acted on this
online
virtual world. And it's just fascinating because it's one of the first like forays into that world. The second book that I really do love is Addiction by Design, which is a book. This anthropologist, Natasha, she studied the Vegas casinos, mm-hmm, and how everything has been created to bring about a sense of addiction. Within a person. And I think that translates so much into the world that we live in right now. Everything has been, in a way, engineered and designed to spark something within us. Third book is another book called Sex at Dawn, which is the evolution and showcasing how the concepts of relationships, marriage, mating, what are social constructs, what have been part and parcel of our civilization. So I like this book because it shows the real evolution of an institution that people hold near and dear to their hearts and see as sacrosanct. It shows the evolution of where did it really come from and what is the value we put. And there's so many.
Yeah, no, that you can send us the links too. But
I will.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad we actually found the time in person with you. I was just thinking about that. It would have been a different energy online. So thank you. We're so grateful. And we're going to stay connected with you. I feel like I still want to have so many more conversations.
Yeah, we should have a part two. Like, after we read these books, I feel like these books had like different like concepts that I have really not thought about.
Yeah. Ooh, one more book, The Body Keeps the Score.
I'm reading that. Yeah. I've almost finished. Yeah.
It's a hard one. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I've picked it up and put it down so many times. It's
just
hard
talking about like how your body keeps trauma. Like,
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It is.
It makes you, like, I think, open your eyes to things that you never really considered before. Like, okay, this happened to me, but it stayed with me.
Yeah. And that's why I'm a huge advocate for yoga.
Yeah.
It really helps you understand your body and yourself.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It was a real pleasure.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks.